to jest podcast System Trader, odcinek 57. A dziś zapraszam do wywiadu z Rickiem Ferry, z którym będę rozmawiał o tym, dlaczego większość inwestorów powinna inwestować pasywnie. Zaczynamy.
Interesujesz się inwestowaniem na rynkach kapitałowych? Szukasz swojego sposobu na oszczędzanie i pomnażanie pieniędzy? Zastanawiasz się, jak postawić swoje pierwsze kroki na giełdzie? Ponadto fakty, mity, wywiady i ciekawostki ze świata finansów. To i wiele więcej usłyszysz w podcaście System Trader. Zaprasza Jacek Lempart.
Rick Ferry, gość dzisiejszego odcinka, to osoba doskonale znana w branży inwestycyjnej od lat. Jest emerytowanym oficerem amerykańskiej piechoty morskiej i pilotem myśliwców. Pracował również jako makler oraz zarządzający w firmie inwestycyjnej oraz zdobył tytuł CFA, czyli Międzynarodowego Doradcy Inwestycyjnego. Obecnie zajmuje się głównie konsultingiem w obrębie taniego inwestowania w indeksy. Rick jest też autorem licznych książek dla inwestorów oraz prowadzi podcast Bogleheads, który kierowany jest do każdego, kto szuka rozsądnego podejścia do inwestowania i finansów osobistych. W tym odcinku rozmawiamy o filozofii inwestowania w indeksy zaproponowaną przez Jacka Bogle, założyciela firmy Vanguard. Dowiesz się o powodach, dla których Rick proponuje inwestować poprzez tanie fundusze indeksowe, odradzając aktywnych prób zarządzania portfelem. Rick tłumaczy też, jak podejść do samodzielnej budowy portfela opartego na funduszach ETF. Pytam też mojego gościa m.in. o to, co się stanie, gdy wszyscy zaczną inwestować pasywnie. Jeśli chcesz sam spróbować budowę pasywnego portfela i nie tylko pasywnego portfela, gorąco zachęcam Cię do spróbowania mojej aplikacji System Trader, która posiada kilkadziesiąt gotowych portfeli i strategii inwestycyjnych oraz umożliwia Ci tworzenie Twoich własnych, a przy tym możesz to wszystko przetestować nawet za ostatnie 100 lat wstecz. Wejdź na stronę systemtrader.pl/st po więcej szczegółów. I jeszcze jedno. Ten wywiad jest w języku angielskim, ale na stronie systemtrader.pl/057 znajdziesz tłumaczenie na język polski. Zapraszam serdecznie do wywiadu. Hello Rick and welcome to my show.
Well, thank you for having me, Jacek.
Could you please introduce yourself? I know that you're very well known in the industry, but just for the pure formality, if you could say a few words about yourself and your career.
Well, thank you. I have been an investment advisor here in the United States for more than 32 years. And I had various capacities. I was working in the large banking brokerage industry for 10 years. And then I had a money management company. I started a money management company where we managed investment portfolios for clients using low-cost index funds and exchange-traded funds, UCITS, things like that. And I then sold that business to my business partner at the time. And now I'm doing an hourly advisory model. So instead of managing money, I'm just helping people who want a little bit of help, and I charge by the hour for helping them. Much like a law firm or an accounting firm here in the States would do. But during this whole career, I've formed an investment philosophy that is centered on low-fee, simple, index-type investing. So instead of trying to outperform the markets, we're just trying to get the returns of the markets. And that actually outperforms most other strategies if you can keep your fees low and your taxes low. So that's my philosophy. That's what I've been doing for many years. It's worked very well, and I'll continue to do it.
Okay, thank you. We'll go into more details about this philosophy, but I know also that you are U.S. Marine Corps officer and you are a fighter pilot. So my question is how your military experience can be used on the investment ground. Do you think it may be helpful or maybe it's the opposite?
Well, my military experience was very helpful in determining what is true and what is not true. When you're flying fighter aircraft, and especially when you're coming aboard aircraft carriers, which is something that I did, you have to be very precise. It has to be very accurate. There's no margin of error. You take only facts when you're determining whether you're going to land or not, or in a case of combat, whether you're going to hit a target or not. So it's all fact-based. There is no room for error. There's no room for gross speculation that's not based on fact, because people die if you're wrong, and I could die. So it was that experience of seeking the truth and seeking accuracy and seeking facts is what brought me to the investment philosophy that I currently have, which is, if you want to do well in investing, then just be the markets and don't try to outperform the markets. So it was a fact-finding mission that I was on when I came into the investment industry 30-something years ago, and it led me to this philosophy and belief and strategy of investing, and it's worked.
Right. You mentioned about the philosophy, and in fact, on your website, I found that you said that successful investor possess three attributes. It's just the philosophy, as you mentioned, but there is also strategy and discipline. Could you please explain in more details what's behind that?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking. A philosophy of investing is your overall beliefs about how you can achieve your objectives in the long term. And they're universally held by a group of a lot of people generally. And it breaks in the investment industry, your philosophy breaks down to two different types. You're either a passive investor where you accept the returns of the markets as they are, and that is good enough for you, or you're an active investor and you're trying to beat the markets. You're trying to outperform the markets, generally more costly to try to do that, a lot more work to try to do that, and typically very few people are successful in doing it. So your overall philosophy drives your investment strategy. So what is strategy? Well, now that we have our philosophy, you and I agree that we shouldn't try to outperform. We should just go with the markets as they are. Strategy is what your portfolio would look like and what my portfolio would look like. You are different than me. You have maybe a different tolerance for taking risk. Maybe your job puts you in a field that is more risky than my field. Maybe your tax situation is different than my tax situation. Maybe the investment opportunities that you have at the company you work with through the retirement plan that you have available to you is different than what I have. So within the philosophy, we both have to craft our own strategy, our own portfolio strategy that fits who we are and what opportunities we have given our personal situation and so forth. And so that's strategy. And I like to say that philosophy is universal. There are millions of people who believe in this philosophy of low-fee, passive index investing, probably hundreds of millions of people who believe in it around the world. But you're not going to find two investors who have the exact same portfolio ever. There's always going to be something different about how you're managing your money versus how I'm managing my money. And it should be that way, because there are no two identical people who have identical circumstances and identical experiences and identical backgrounds and identical family situations. So because no one is identical, their portfolios are always going to be somewhat different, even though we all believe in the same philosophy. We are going to adjust our portfolios based on our strategy that we need for our individual needs. Now, the third part of that, which is discipline, is once you have the broad philosophy and once you work on developing a strategy which will get you to your financial goals and beyond, now you have to have the discipline to implement that strategy and to stay with that strategy in the long term, because that's the only thing that makes it work. So you need to have a discipline of the philosophy to maintain the philosophy, to not get up one morning and say, oh, I've decided now I'm going to try to beat the market, so I'm going to change everything. You must have a discipline of the philosophy and then the strategy that you put together for your particular situation, the mix between stocks and bonds and where they are and how much cash you should have and how you're going to work your taxes in and all of these issues that come up. You have to be disciplined in your approach to implementing that and maintaining that. So it takes three things to be successful. The philosophy, a strategy that works for you, and then the discipline to maintain it. And that's where I come up with that diagram.
And what's the border, if it's possible to put a border between index passive investing, let's say, and active investing? Because, for example, I see some people are saying that, okay, active investing is too hard, it's too difficult, so I go for ETFs. But then they are starting, you know, slicing and dicing, and they are saying things like, for example, now USA is too expensive, so maybe I will put more China in my portfolio, or I want to maybe put some momentum ETF into my portfolio, and so on. How to solve that? I mean, how to approach it, and where to say, where's the border between active and passive investing?
So what you described is an active bet. It's a bet, meaning that you're trying to outperform. When you say things like the US is too expensive, you're making a judgment on the valuation of the US market based on some fundamental, and you're making a valuation of the Chinese market based on probably the same fundamental, like price to earnings or growth potential, GDP, whatever it is, whatever fundamental that you're making this decision. That all sounds very good. And it appears that, sure, the US is expensive, so we should put money in China because China is less expensive. Therefore, we should outperform. It all sounds good. The problem is it doesn't work good. It doesn't come out that way. I mean, it's a flip of a coin, basically. There's a 50% chance you're going to be right and a 50% chance you're going to be wrong. The problem is when you're wrong, you have to change it again, and generally you're going to do something else wrong. And in the long term, you would have been better off not making these bets, just having an allocation that makes sense, that for the long term, let's assume the markets are going to be closed for 10 years and you need to do an allocation and the markets are going to be closed for 10 years after that. And then 10 years from now, here you are. You can't change it. That actually works better than trying to pick winners or pick losers. In the long term, that active management is what causes people to underperform what they would have done if they just had a fixed allocation to these countries or these asset classes and maintained it, rebalanced once in a while, and not worry about whether one is overvalued or one is undervalued. Because if it really was overvalued and China really was undervalued, why should it be that easy to make money? It's not. You have PhDs, very brilliant minds all over the world trying to figure that stuff out. Why should you have the knowledge when they don't to be able to figure this stuff out? It's just not that easy. It might appear to be that easy. You might hear it in the media that it's very clear that this is the way, this is what was going to happen. But, you know, it's really not predictable. It's only predictable in retrospect. Hindsight is 20/20. We can always look backwards and say, oh, well, that was obvious. That was obvious we were in a bubble. Or that was obvious that that was undervalued. That's how that type of money management is sold. But in reality, going forward today, nothing is obvious. Nothing is certain. We don't know whether or not the US is overvalued and China is undervalued. We don't know that. I mean, we're not going to know that until 10 or 15 years from now, where we look back and say, oh, yes, we were right. Or, boy, am I glad I didn't do that, because I would have been really wrong. The best thing to do is not to do that. That's what the philosophy is about.
Right. So it seems like overconfidence is a part of our nature, and that's what is very, very bad for on the investment ground. But you mentioned on your website that the typical way for index investor is like this. We are starting in the darkness, then we go through the enlightenment, then through complexity, and we end up in simplicity. Could you please explain all these phases?
Yes, I would be happy to. So we're talking about philosophy, the first part of the three legs of the stool to get you to be a successful investor. This is the philosophy side. How do you get a philosophy? How do you acquire a philosophy of low fee, passive, index investing in your portfolio before you even develop your strategy of the philosophy? How does the philosophy develop? And this is the four stages. It's the four stages of investor or index investor growth or knowledge. The first stage is darkness. And this is, you don't know much about investing at all. So you're at the very first stage, you're asking your friends, you're maybe watching something on the internet, some video about how to pick hot stocks or how to pick mutual funds that are going to outperform. You're just fishing all over the place. You're looking all over the place for how to put together a portfolio because it's all new, or maybe it's not new. You just haven't done the work to dig into what actually does well for you in the long term. So this is darkness. But if you start keeping track, you actually look at your performance and you start looking at the performance of all of the things that you may have chosen or that other people recommended versus what the markets did. And if you keep very good records and you take an academic view of all of this, you'll come to the realization that, if all I did was get the returns of the market, I would have outperformed 90% of all of that other stuff that I was hearing about in darkness. When you get to that point, it's the second level, which I called enlightenment. You have become enlightened to the fact that the markets do just fine all by themselves. You don't have to do anything. You just invest in the markets in total, buy the markets, and you will do better than most people will do who are trying to beat the markets. So that's enlightenment. But then they get to a different stage, and you touched on this. Well, what about if we take the markets and we slice them and dice them into various components like small cap value and maybe international stocks, and we start comparing all these different parts of the index, and then we take the index apart and put it back together in a way that is even better than what the index is. This is what I call complexity. In other words, you believe in indexing. You believe in not trying to pick individual companies, but now you're looking at the world of indexing and all the different indexes that are out there for bond markets and stock markets, various country markets, and you have come to this conclusion that, I can actually do better than that using indexes, but I can do better by slicing and dicing these indexes and putting them all back together again in a different kind of a way, and therefore, that is a more scientific, it's what they call it. It's not really science, but they call it scientific way of achieving higher returns. So using indexing, using the philosophy, but in an active sort of way. This is what I call complexity. You have had enlightenment. You have realized the idea of using indexes to beat most other investors and most other strategies, but now you're getting so deep into indexing that you're starting to see things back the way you saw them when you were in darkness doing active management. But now, of course, you're enlightened, so it's different, but it's really not different because in the end, you end up underperforming again. Okay. So finally, when you realize this, you come to this realization that you're moving this stuff around from value to growth to large cap, small cap, this, that, US over to China, back to US again, and you're moving all these things around within the indexing universe, you realize that you were still underperforming. You go back to the second stage, only now it's enlightenment with simplicity. Let's keep it simple. All right, let's just buy a simple portfolio of a few index funds and just leave it and just go on with my life and go and, you know, go on with my career, go on with my family, and just let that do what it will do all by itself without me messing with it. And that's the final stage of the philosophy, which is the simplicity of index investing. And those are the four stages of the philosophy.
Right. Very interesting. But again, in the end, the human nature says that people prefer just the complexity for some reason. Do you believe that individual investor can have, in fact, an active winning strategy and be able to use it? Because I fully agree that data says that indeed most active investors have worse results than an index investors. But data also says that there are certain anomalies, market anomalies, like momentum, for example, which do exist and is repeatable. Even Eugene Fama confirms that there is such anomaly. But do you believe that it can be used on a practical ground successfully by an individual investor?
Okay, all we know is the probability that it may be successful in the future. We know what the past has said, but we really don't know what the future is going to be. We can assess a probability to it, but we can't be sure that it's going to happen. We can't be sure that a momentum strategy is going to outperform or a value strategy is going to outperform. We can assess a probability, but it's the best that you can do. If you take something like small cap investing, where you're investing in small companies, the research on that was done, I want to say, in the late 1970s or maybe the early 1970s, where it was discovered that if you invested in small cap stocks, the smallest companies, that you got a higher rate of return relative to the extra risk that you took. So you had to take extra risk to invest in small cap companies. But even considering the extra risk that you took, you got an extra return even above that. It was called the small cap premium. And the reason you got that, it was, well, that it's still being debated, but there's a liquidity problem there. It's hard to trade those stocks. But anyway, that all that research came out in the 70s and started to become implemented in the 1980s here in the States. And since then, there hasn't been a small cap premium. It hasn't worked. Value investing started to be very hot in this country in the 1990s when you said Gene Fama and Ken French, Gene Fama, a Nobel laureate, and Ken French, his research partner, wrote something called the three-factor equation, which looked at the markets and said, well, small caps do outperform, at least in 1994. You're looking backwards, they did. And value stocks, you know, these are companies that have a lot of debt. They have low earnings growth. Their price-to-earnings ratios are low, price-to-sales. I mean, they just, you look at these companies and they're rather unattractive companies. But they outperform growth stocks, glamour stocks like Google and so forth. Value stocks tend to outperform. At least that's what the research says. Well, value investing got to be very attractive by the early 2000s, like 2004, 2005. But since then, there has been a very poor returns. And going back over a 15-year period of time, 20-year period of time, looking at the entire spectrum since that research came out, there hasn't been a value premium. So the funny thing is, when these anomalies are discovered and they're published and everybody starts to do them, it seems to stop working. Now, I'm not going to say it's going to never work again going forward. I'm saying that no one would have predicted the probability that it wasn't going to work was very low, and yet this is what happened. Now, how many people, and here's where the discipline comes in, How many people are disciplined enough to stick with a value strategy or a momentum strategy? Cliff Asness helped develop this strategy from AQR. How many people are going to stick with a strategy for 20 years when it's not working or it's not outperforming? And this is where the discipline comes in. Most people are not going to stick with it. They're going to try it for 4 or 5 years. If it underperforms, they're going to leave it and they're going to go on to something else. This is how you end up not even keeping up with the markets. So my point on keeping it simple is if you don't do that, if you don't add that level of complexity to your portfolio, then you're going to do what the markets do and you're going to do better than 90% of everybody else. But if you do decide to do that, if you do decide to have a value element in your portfolio and a momentum element in your portfolio and a small cap element in your portfolio because you believe the academic data and you assign a high probability to these factors outperforming the market in the future, you have to stay with them for 25 years. And that's not an arbitrary number, 25 years. I mean, I talked with several PhDs, Wes Gray here, University of Chicago PhD. He owns a company called Alpha Architect. We crunched this number down. You have to be disciplined with that strategy for 25 years to maybe get outperformance. Now, how many people are going to be that disciplined for that long? Very few, which gets us back to if you just keep it simple and have a simple strategy that just tracks the markets and just go to work, go enjoy your family, go do something else, you're probably going to be better off.
Right. Very interesting. But I have another question then. What happens if everyone would then invest following index philosophy, which I fully buy? I mean, it's really convincing to me. But will this index philosophy still work if everyone does it? Because we said that if everyone would start using momentum, for example, it may disappear. But in the end, the role of markets is to find the value of assets. So can all participants on the market be passive? Do you think that maybe, on the other hand, if more people would invest passively, then maybe it will be easier to find the active strategy? What's your opinion here?
Well, people have been making the argument that as more people use passive index investing, it becomes easier for the active managers to find investments that are going to outperform. They've been saying that since the 1970s when indexes first appeared. The fact is, there's no evidence of that whatsoever. Even today, there's no evidence that active managers are able to take advantage of the move towards indexing. But let me also state that index investing is not a very large part of the stock market. It's maybe 15%. That's it. I think that there's a misunderstanding of how much of the aggregate supply of stock that's out there and bonds are actually part of a simple index fund. It's not nearly as high as what a lot of people believe. Most of the money is still actively managed. Most of the money, also there's money in private hands, and there's money in the companies themselves. So you were asking about trying to find a fair value for each particular stock. Stocks are traded day in and day out by lots of participants out there. I mean, there are companies trading in their own stock. There are private equity investors trading in stock. There are active managers trading in stock. The indexers don't trade generally. They just buy and pack it away. They're not trading. So they're not really making the market. They're just accepting whatever these other people are doing as the price. But those other people, they are numerous. And many different people are out there trading individual securities and will continue to do so. Companies themselves are constantly issuing stock and buying back stock. We have a lot of stock compensation programs here in the United States where employees, higher level employees, get stock bonus by stock. And in order to give them their stock bonus, the company actually has to go out into the open market and buy that stock in the open market and bring it in and then reissue it out to their own employees who then go out and sell it again. So this is active market that's going on which dwarfs the amount of trading that is going on in index funds. So to your point, will it not work? It will continue to work for as long as I'm alive, for as long as my children are alive, for as long as my grandchildren are alive, and as long as my great-grandchildren are alive. So that probably covers the spectrum for anybody listening to this podcast.
I often see that people are looking for, let's say, perfect portfolio, perfect pie, and they are trying to, you know, select the best ETFs, but they are rarely talking about psychological aspects of investing. And we covered quite a lot about discipline as such. But the question is, how to acquire enough discipline to stay the course, as Jack Bogle was saying, how to get confidence? Because as you said, with the momentum strategy, with the value strategy, you may have to stick with it even 25 years to see the results, and still they are not guaranteed. But with the passive investing, with the index investing, you also have to be very patient, and you also have to sometimes wait for years until you will see the results. So you cannot just assume that you'll get the results instantly. So how to get that confidence to stick with that portfolio?
Well, we have something here in this country we call the school of hard knocks. And that is that after you've tried everything else and you realize it's not working, that just give up, give into this idea, and just let it do what it's going to do. If the markets are going down, it doesn't matter if you're a passive investor, you're an active investor. Odds are you're going to be losing money because the markets are going down. So it's just a matter of degrees. So it's hard. It's like gambling, right? It's trying to make a living picking winning sports teams and betting odds and so forth. There's a spread in the middle between, you know, one side and the other, where the bookies, we call them here, make their money. But to try to be right more than you're wrong is extremely difficult. And after a while, you get worn down. And I think that has a lot to do with accepting this. Let me put it this way. I think that might describe some investors, people who are really trying to get into the complexity. They're in darkness, and then they get enlightenment, and they go to complexity. They're trying to angle in on this thing. They're saying there must be a way of outperforming. I mean, look at the famous investors out there like Warren Buffett. I mean, he did it. Yes, but you're not Warren Buffett. Okay, and there's no reason why you should outperform. So, you know, once you get to this stage, you say, yes, this is true. Just like I'm never going to be a world champion tennis player. Okay, I could pick up tennis when I'm 60 years old. I'm never going to be a world champion tennis player. And it's the same thing with investing. If there's very, very few people who are actually going to be able to outperform, and unless you've been studying this for years and years and years. And of course, that doesn't guarantee it either, because there are people who play tennis for years and years and years and never became top professional players. But my point is that there are going to be some who are going to outperform, but they're very, very few. But we tend to put them on a pedestal, and they become sort of our heroes. And we say, well, Warren Buffett did it, you can do it too. And books are written how to be Warren Buffett and how you can invest like Warren Buffett and all this other stuff. But it's just not true. It's not true. Well, I can't say it's not true. There's a very low probability that that is actually going to happen. It's a much higher probability you're going to do worse than just the markets. And when you get to that point, you sort of throw in the towel in many ways and say, this is what, okay, I'm going to do it that way. Now, there's also a group of people who are much smarter than me who did it right from the beginning. You know, they went to the right people. Maybe they listened to a podcast like this. And they said, you know what? I'm not even going to bother with all that. I'm not going to try to become a professional tennis player. Okay. I'm just going to buy the average. I'm just going to buy the markets, and I'm just going to get what the market returns on. I'm going to do it in a very low cost and tax efficient way. And I'm going to have the right strategy for me going long term. I'm going to work on that. And then I'm going to go on with my life, and I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to let it work. Those people become very successful investors. Now, they're lucky, because somebody either told them or they learned about it early in life. The rest of us suffered through this other four phases before we finally had the the last phase of simplicity. This is what we should have been doing all our lives, okay? But when you get there, you have to just, you just do it. I mean, it just becomes a, this is it. This is what's going to work for me. This is what I'm going to do. You implement it and you go on with life. And you find out that, you know what? This actually works. And then you actually at that point have moved up to the altar. In other words, I call this coming into the church of indexing and then moving up in the pews until you get to the altar. And then hopefully when you finally get to the altar and you're just doing this, hopefully what you'll do after that is you'll join the choir and you'll start telling other people about it. And that's how it spreads.
Right. And by the way, as Warren Buffett says, investing is simple but not easy, and there is something in it. Let's say that we have a young person which is able to put aside some money each month, and let's say that that person is having an investment perspective measured in decades until the retirement. So what is how the correct way of building a portfolio should look like? And what should be the minimal time horizon for such a lazy portfolio? If let's say that person is going to invest into index fund or just have a lazy portfolio?
Well, that's a good question. You're saying that a person who's young, how should they invest their portfolio? So what should their strategy be? We're going to assume they have the philosophy. They're going to just buy a few index funds. The question is, what should the strategy be? And the strategy begins with, what should your mix be between stocks, which are growth assets, participating in the ownership of companies, and fixed income or bonds that pay interest. Not much these days, but some interest, where they're safe, they don't move around, but you get a little bit of return on the interest. You're letting someone or you're letting a bank borrow your money. And so what should the mix be between stocks and bonds? That's the first question. And that is a difficult question because there's two sides to that. The first side is, well, what's going to give me the best return? And clearly, if you're young, what's going to give you the best return long-term is being more in stocks. Stocks are going to outperform bonds. Companies borrow money so that they can invest money and get better rates of return. Therefore, if you invest in the company and buy the stock, you should get a better rate of return than what it's costing them to borrow the money. So stocks should produce higher rate of return. We call this an equity risk premium. You're taking risk, you have to suffer through the volatility of it all, you should get a higher rate of return in the long term. That's the whole point of doing equity investing. However, how much of your behavioral person that you are is going to be able to handle that? That's the other side of the coin, the emotional side. Technically, we can say, sure, if you're young, you should have all stock all the time. Don't even think about it. Just put it all in the stock market and just let it go and just keep on putting more in. If the market goes down, even better. You get to buy cheaper. Just keep on putting it in for 30 years and then you wake up one morning and you don't have to work anymore for the rest of your life if you don't want to. Right? That's the sort of the fairy tale view of it all. The problem is the other side. It's the emotional side. It's the behavioral side. Are you going to be able to do that? Can you stand to watch the value of your portfolio sometimes go down by 30, 40, 50, 60% some years? Can you stand that? And a lot of people cannot. And they'll capitulate. They'll throw in the towel. And when are they going to throw in the towel? When it's down 30, 40, or 50%, 60%. That destroys their retirement plan, destroys their savings plan if they do that. So that person who would do that, who would throw in the towel, needs to have a good portion of their portfolio in bonds to offset this downturn that is going to occur. We do know that. It has to occur. There has to be bear markets because it has to shake out all the people who shouldn't be in them to begin with. There has to be bear markets. And there will be bear markets to push out what we call the weak players. That's what gives us, the people who are strong players, the ability to make more money. Okay, so the weak players get shook out, but you have to be a strong player. But to what extent, what level of equity in your portfolio is going to allow you to stay the course, to hang in there? Maybe it's only 50% stocks and 50% in bonds. Maybe it's only 30% in stock. Maybe it's 70%. Maybe you're the rare person who could handle 100% of stock 100% of the time. I don't know that. But I, one of the things that I do with my clients is I really try to draw this out of them. We have to find that out first. That's the very first thing we have to find out. What are you going to do the next time you lose half your money? What are you going to do? If the answer is, I'm going to buy more, well, are you just telling me that or are you actually going to do it? Because there's a difference here, right? And I know from a fact of being an investment advisor, everybody is brave in a bull market. Everybody will tell their advisor, oh, yes, I'm going to hang in there and I'm going to buy more. But do they actually do it? And the answer is no, a lot of people don't. They get scared out. So we got to find what is the happy medium that's going to keep you there. So when the market goes up, this is the description of a person who is in the right spot, has the right allocation. The market goes up and they say, oh, you know, God, I wish I had more money in the market. You know, the market went up. I only had maybe 50% in the market. I wish I had more money in the market. But they don't do anything about it. They don't go out and buy more stock now. And then the market turns around and goes down 50%. And they go, oh my gosh, you know, half of my portfolio is in stock. And I wish I didn't have that much in stock. I kind of wish I only had maybe 30%. But I have 50%. Well, now actually, I probably maybe have 30%. But I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm just going to leave it like it is. Guess what? You didn't do anything when the market went up, and you didn't do anything when the market went down. You're in a good spot. Okay, you're at your risk level. That's where you should be. So when you don't do anything when the market goes up, you don't try to buy more, and you don't do anything when the market goes down by trying to sell, you're in a good spot. Now, if you happen to, when the market goes down, if you happen to do a rebalancing and buy more to get back to 50%, even better. But when the market goes back up and you're sitting at 70% stocks, you need to bring it back down to 50 because now you have too much stock. So you can do what's called a rebalancing in your portfolio. But that's where you want to be. And if you can figure out where that is, then you can be a very successful investor and not have 100% in stocks. So this is the first key. And then after that, once you get to, by the way, that is 90% of investing right there, 90%. The other 10% is what I call the icing on the cake. Now you have your stock portfolio. Oh, how much is going to be in the US? How much is going to be out in China? How much is going to be in Europe? How much is going to be here? How much is going to be there? It's taking that stock portfolio and diversifying it logically and just keeping it that way. But that only really drives maybe 10% of the return in the very long term. If it's diversified, it doesn't matter if you're 30% in the US or 35. It doesn't, it's not going to matter at all in the long term. It really doesn't. And you wouldn't know if whether or not it's going to matter. So that doesn't matter very much. Just having it diversified globally in equities is really what matters. And once you get there, that is your allocation that you stick with. You don't try to move it around because if you do, you're probably not going to do as well as just sticking with your initial allocation. So the big thing is your asset allocation between stocks, bonds, and then a cash component, which is going to be your emergency fund, money that you need for buying things and buying a home, maybe buying an automobile or something later on down the road. I mean, that's a different pot of money, but this is how you do it. And once you figure out your asset allocation between stocks and bonds, and you come up with a portfolio of stock index funds that satisfies you for the long term. And this, nobody knows what the perfect or the optimal mix of global markets are going to be. Nobody knows that. We can't know that. So you come up with something reasonable, useful, that you can stick with for the long term. And you just implement it and you maintain it and you just never look back on it. And you just keep on doing that year after year after year after year. And this is how you become a successful investor in the very long term. I've seen it. I mean, I personally have experienced it with my clients over 25 years of doing this. I've been doing index investing for 25 years. I have seen clients become multimillionaires in this country just by doing this strategy and not doing other things. It works. And there's no reason why it's not going to work over the next 25 years.
Very interesting. Thank you for that. You mentioned quite a lot about bonds, and the last four decades were quite, let's say, happy for bonds because of the interest rates which were going down. But we had already the period of time in the last century, also in the United States, over four decades, where the real returns from bonds were, in fact, negative if we apply inflation on that. And do you think that because of that, we should also consider adding maybe some linked, inflation-linked bonds to our portfolio, just because of the fact that we are living in the era of low interest rate?
Interest rates since 1980, so for the last 40 years, have been coming down. And so there's been an excess return from bonds. It's almost, I want to call it a artificial return. Not artificial, but it's not really an indication of what bonds return in the long term. Bonds in the very long term maybe return 1% over the rate of inflation. Now, right now, it's even below that, because central banks all over the world are lowering rates so much to try to stem off the COVID virus to keep their economies going and to also finance their own governments at a very low interest rate that's below the inflation rate as they buy government bonds, that the return from bonds going forward is not even going to be the inflation rate, let alone 1% over the inflation rate. So to your point, what if you bought inflation-linked bonds? This is a good idea, because at least you're going to get what the inflation rate is. Unfortunately, everybody has figured this out. So the yield on inflation-linked bonds, if there was no inflation, at least here in the United States, if inflation was zero, the yield or the interest rate on inflation-adjusted bonds is negative 1%. I mean, you have to actually pay the government to own these bonds. It's negative 1%. So not only do you need inflation of 1% just to break out even, but you need to have a jump in inflation of 2 or 3% to make money on inflation-adjusted bonds. In other words, you need an unanticipated jump in the rate of inflation. And the reason I say unanticipated is because an anticipated inflation rate is already built into the price, which is why it's negative 1% yield. Unanticipated inflation is everybody thinks that inflation is going to maybe be 2% because that's what the central banks are targeting. But in fact, it jumps to 4%. If there's that jump in inflation, an unanticipated jump up to 3% and 4%, then you'll make more money in inflation-linked bonds. But if there isn't, if inflation is as expected, which here in the States is about 2%, you're not going to make any more money in inflation-linked bonds. And if inflation is actually lower than that, if it's down at 1% or if inflation goes to 0%, there is no inflation, you're going to lose money. You're going to lose over 1% a year in inflation-adjusted bonds. So it's not a guarantee. It is part of a diversified portfolio, so you can hedge against a jump and unanticipated inflation. But it's just one part of a bond portfolio.
All right. Thank you for that. We are reaching to the end slowly, but let me ask you the last question. On your blog and also in a great article for Forbes, you wrote that you cannot measure the quality of a man by the size of his bank account, but in John Bogle's case, you can measure it by the size of your bank account. Could you please tell us more about John Bogle and why he's such an icon?
Yeah, thank you for asking. John Bogle saw that index investing was a wonderful idea. He saw this back in the early 1970s. At that time, there were no index funds available. You couldn't buy the market. It was a great idea to buy the market, but you couldn't buy the stock market. You couldn't buy the bond market. He was the CEO, head executive of a company called Vanguard at the time. It was a new company that was formed back then. And he decided that he was going to take this company in that direction. So he launched the very first index mutual fund, the very first one available to investors. individual investors like you and I. And it took 10 years before that caught on. I mean, literally, nobody knew what it was. Nobody understood why you ever needed this thing. But eventually, it began to prove itself, and it took 10 years. It caught on, and money started going into index investing as more and more people began to understand it. This is now, say, the mid-1980s. But by 1990, when I first discovered indexing, he had moved into international index funds, bond index funds, real estate index funds. He had created at Vanguard a series of index funds where you could, for a very, very low cost, you could buy entire markets, the entire bond market, the entire U.S. equity market, the entire international market. And for the very first time, individual investors could put together a low-cost portfolio, broadly diversified, that covered the entire globe. And it was a revolution that occurred. And then different ways of delivering index funds came about, such as exchange-traded funds, UCITS, things like this. And they just made it even more popular. So today, it is wildly successful and has been a tremendous benefit to individual investors. So as I said in that quote, you can't measure a person by the size of his purse, but in John Bogle's case, you can measure it by the size of your purse, which basically means you have more money today if you've done this because of John Bogle. He was a great man, and we miss him greatly.
Right. Thank you. Is there anything you would like to add before we will finish today's interview?
I just hope that your listeners take this to heart and continue to educate yourselves on what this philosophy of investing is. It is the best way, in my opinion, to achieve your financial goals. And there's a lot of information out there. There's becoming more information out there. There's becoming more products available to you out there to do this philosophy, to create a strategy for you. And I just wish everyone luck.
Thank you so much, Rick, for your time. It was a great pleasure to have you on my podcast. I'm sure that listeners, they will find a lot of value in what you said and explained to us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.